Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Nina Sun, and I am an associate editor for the SRHM Journal. In this episode, we listen to a recent discussion on battling misinformation and disinformation, sexual and reproductive health and rights in the digital age. This discussion, held on the 25th of January, 2024, was co-organized by SRHM and the USC Institute on Inequalities in Global Health. It was moderated by the Institute's director and SRHM trustee, Sophia Gruskin. We hear from Anne Philpotts, founder of the Pleasure Project, Esther Kismodi, chief executive of SRHM, Kat Lowe, content moderation lead for Midan, a global technology not-for-profit, and Lisa Mangaldas, India's foremost pleasure-positive content creator. This one-hour virtual event brought together key actors to discuss how information, misinformation, and disinformation in our current digital age impacts sexual and reproductive health and rights, with a particular focus on sexuality education, contraception, and abortion. Panelists discuss strategies to address these challenges and to ensure that the transformative potential of technology can reach those who need it most and support agency, bodily autonomy, and decision-making for all individuals. We hope you enjoy this rich discussion.
Hi, everybody, and welcome. My name is Sophia Gruskin, and I direct the Institute on Inequalities in Global Health at the University of Southern California. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to today's dialogue, Battling Misinformation and Disinformation, Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights in the Digital Age. And I have to start with a thank you to Sexual and Reproductive Health Matters for partnering on this event, and particularly to our panelists and my dear friend, Esther Kismodi, and the amazing team at SRHM. I'm really grateful to your collaboration for making this happen and to all these amazing panelists for promoting this event with your networks and bringing us all together. So let me just start by saying that I'm excited about this event for a number of reasons. And first, I need to say that as the Institute on Inequalities in Global Health, we, in some ways, felt compelled to bring this event to all of you. We have worked for many, many years in the sexual and reproductive health and rights space. But more recently, and I'm actually assuming for many of you, it's the same reason you've all chosen to be here, we've really been concerned about the intersections of SRHR and bodily autonomy with technology. And recently, we've put some of our engagement in this area into action through a partnership with Durex, under this fancy name of the Durex USC IIGH Global Initiative on Young People's Sexual Rights and Health. And there's a lot that's exciting about this partnership, which I'd be happy to talk about. But the one piece I want to call out today is the effort to support young people to be informed global champions on topics of sexual health and rights in the digital space. And it's really clear to us that this can only happen if we not only address access to information, but the harmful impacts of misinformation and disinformation. So we really see this event as one step in how we're going to learn to communicate better about these issues so that ultimately young people are better equipped to advocate themselves for their sexual and reproductive health and rights in the digital sphere. Second, just to focus on the topic of this event, we're going to, with the help of these amazing panelists, learn how they address misinformation and disinformation in our current digital age, and the strategies that they're using not only to address these challenges, but really to try to ensure the transformative potential of technology so that technology can actually be better harnessed to support agency, bodily autonomy, and decision-making in the sexual health space. And I have to say something about the range of disciplines and organizations involved in this dialogue, people on this panel, but also in the virtual audience. So we have a lot of old friends and a lot of new faces joining, people that span international NGOs, academia, private sector, the UN system, governments, content creation spaces, and literally from every region of the world. So I'm grateful to have everybody here and for these amazing panelists, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation. So with that, let me briefly introduce our esteemed panelists, knowing you've seen their amazing bios online. So I'm just going to go very quickly for the sake of time, but please do look folks up just so you have a sense of kind of the completeness of who people are, because I'm not going to do anyone justice. I'm going by first name alphabetical. So Ann Philpott, public health professional, pleasure propagandist, well-known guerrilla girl of HIV prevention. She founded the Pleasure Project in 2004, and she's done incredible work to influence key decision makers and gatekeepers to deliver more effective and sex-positive content. And obviously, there's a lot more to say. Esther Kishmoti, Chief Executive of Sexual and Reproductive Health Matters, which I think everyone knows, promotes sexual and reproductive health and rights globally through both their open access journal and their advocacy work. And I suggest everyone get a subscription to SRHM if you haven't already done so. But for Esther, she is an international human rights lawyer specializing in sexuality, sexual and reproductive health and rights, and gender diversity. And she's worked all over the world with all types of partners. And again, lots more I could say. Kat Lowe, content moderation lead for MeDone and a research affiliate at the Center for Responsible, Ethical, and Accessible Technology at UC Irvine. Her work is amazing. I've just met her, and it includes working with organizations to identify and manage the mental health risks of people that they face in fact-checking and moderation work they do in the digital space. And much of her work is in support of technology-supported collective action for marginalized and underserved communities. And again, a lot more to say. And last but certainly not least, Lisa Mangaldas, who is known as India's foremost pleasure-positive content creator, as well as serving as the founder of pleasure and intimacy products brand Lizus. Her sex education videos on social media reach millions of people in India and around the world. She does this daily. She's amazing. She's won several key awards for her work. She's a UN Women Ally and a Pleasure Project Fellow, and clearly a lot more to say. So please do look at everybody's bios online. And I'm really hoping that this can be a conversation amongst us all. So just to ask the audience, please do use the Q&A function for any questions you might want to pose to our panelists. And we're going to take some time at the end to include that in the discussion. So with that, if I can begin. So this is a question I'm going to ask each of you, and no particular order, but I'll kind of go like who I see on my screen. But just to situate the conversation, can you tell us quickly about the work that you do in this space and when you first started to see or make connections between sexual and reproductive health and rights and digital technologies? And I mean that either personally or in the context of your work. Please, if you would go ahead, just because of how you are on my screen, Lisa, do you mind starting us off?
Thanks so much, Sophia. And it's an honor to be part of this panel. The reason that I took to social media to start talking about sex and sexual health from the perspective of an ordinary person, a non-doctor, a non-policymaker, and an unmarried person, which, you know, in India, I mean, unmarried, non-doctor, non-policymaker women should not talk about sex, right? Women not to talk about it. And I think, therefore, there's a lot of pushback, even within offline spaces. And the internet initially seemed like the only place where you could perhaps have some of these conversations safely. Unfortunately, that's changed over the 7 years that I'm doing it, where the internet now feels much less like the utopia it felt like in the early days. But I started doing sort of almost as a passion project, really, without ever thinking it could become as big as it is. Today, I have over 3 million people following what I put out across platforms. When I started, I thought if even three women wanted to talk to me about contraception or pleasure or experiences with gynecologists, or I mean, really anything in this umbrella, I'd be so down because no one talks about it. And it's really, as a young person navigating your own sexual health and relationships, it's kind of really unfortunate not to be able to have spaces where you can share or learn, right? So I think to a large degree for young people in India, there's an absence of information, right? And when there's an absence of information plus shame, you're just so vulnerable to misinformation and disinformation. And so it came from a place of wishing there was a resource, not having that resource that was culturally contextualized, also non-judgmental, scientifically accurate, and peer-to-peer, as opposed to someone talking down at people, trying to warn them of the dangers of sex and refuse to talk about pleasure, or which is why I'm such a fan of Anne as well. So I wanted to create the digital resource I wish I had. I realized you can reach so many people through the internet. India had just gotten cheap mobile data plans, as a result of which internet penetration just skyrocketed right around the time that I started doing what I do. And obviously porn is also much easier to find than comprehensive sex education on the internet. And so it seemed like we should replicate the delivery mechanism, like make pleasure positive, LGBTQ plus positive, inclusive sex ed easily available. It should just be served to people. It should pop up on your screen. And how do you do that? On social media. So that's a little bit about me.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And I think with that, let's go to Anne next, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on and inviting the Pleasure Project to this. And yeah, huge thanks to Lisa. I agree with everything that you said, but just in terms of when the kind of light bulb moment was for me, I mean, the Pleasure Project, I set the Pleasure Project up nearly two decades ago now, and it was set up out of pure frustration because I was working in HIV prevention and condom promotion. And what I was seeing in the work that I was doing and the amazing skills that many people had who were everyday navigating condom use or regularly navigating safer sex was that they had amazing ways of eroticizing condom use. There was amazing kind of lived experiences which weren't being replicated in the policy forums or in academic forums that I was also connected to, such as the global AIDS conferences, where frankly, pleasure was never discussed. And the reasons why people have sex or what they could gain from having safer sex was something that was completely absent. The conversation was much more dominated by obsessed with the negative consequences of sex or bad sex and death, danger and disease. So the Pleasure Project was flying a flag for pleasure and how safer sex can be good for your health. And I think I've always been interested in the Pleasure Project in building bridges between different worlds and between research and practitioners, but also between those who make porn and explicit media and those who have sexual health expertise. And so as long ago as 15 years ago, I worked with, or longer actually, with feminist porn filmmakers to be a condom consultant in the making of a film called Modern Loving. That was actually produced on DVDs. But I wrote something just shortly after that, a chapter in a book about how the public health world was avoiding porn at its costs and sticking its head in the sand. And then that has, you know, I've kept saying that because, as Lisa says, the access to explicit media and porn, it, you know, way dwarfs access to sex education. And part of that has been how the platforms have changed and how people have got access to mobile phones. But it's also because people access it more. And as Lisa said, we need to replicate the delivery model and actually try and make fun, sexy, pleasure-focused, but much more reliable content. I mean, also the fact that so many people are learning about sex from porn is very damaging. I mean, porn's not just one, it's not monolithic. There's lots of different elements to production and there's ethical feminist porn as well, but the vast majority of it is really damaging. And so we've been working with and have made some explicit sex education films that we're testing in a big trial, which is also where people get STI results on their phone from postal sexually transmitted infections kits in the UK. But we've also seen a lot of evidence of people using digital interventions to great effect when that content is more pleasure positive. And I can talk about that more later on in this webinar. But that's it from me.
Super interesting. Thank you. Thank you. Esther, please.
Thank you so much. And it's such a great pleasure for inviting me and also SRA to be a partner in organizing and being in the panel. I'm representing as a chief executive the Sexual and Reproductive Health Matters Journal. And I would like to use the journal experience, especially in the past decade, about the relationship with digital technology and specifically about misinformation, misuse of information, because we really, it's like three major events that contributed to a very expansive and very intimate and intense engagement of the journal with digital technology. One of them started before COVID slightly when we engaged with WHO to publish literature that they have been collecting in relation to self-care. And we received a lot of information, and it's very interesting that how we went kind of pre-COVID, COVID, post-COVID documentation of engagement with digital technology. And the self-care, really the self-care intervention guideline was targeting that how digital technology can be used for increasing accessibility, availability, quality of services worldwide. But then COVID hit, and then we got really a huge expansion of information about it. It was MSI, I think Catherine is in the participant list. We started to get information that how actually digital is helping to access services. But right away, we started to get concerns from especially communities of sex workers, disability, global south, that wait a minute, promoting digital technology so widely because there is so much about, and I will talk about it, about digital divide, gender divide of digital technology and many other concerns. And then post-COVID, we were so excited of going deeper in understanding the issues through research, through discussion spaces, through kind of webinars, really expanding our partnerships within the SRHR sector and beyond the SRHR sector, especially in the Global South, to understand what's happening. So our last year, we launched our digital technology special issue that is really collecting a lot of evidence from Venezuela to Senegal to Kenya, Australia, among different population groups, that about the advantages and misuse of digital technology and information. And through our knowledge and action focus, we also got very much involved to see that how the anti-gender, anti-sexual and reproductive health and rights movement is actually misusing information, and how as a scientific evidence and gender-based and rights-based knowledge creation entity, how we need to take the responsibility to counter misinformation that is put out by this anti-gender, anti-SRHR movement, that is a very new phenomena that we didn't, we took evidence granted before. And I think it needs a very different research, evidence, more mindful thinking about how we take evidence for granted as it is science and rights-based.
Yeah, we definitely want to come back to that. Kat, please.
So I think a lot of my work in the space is around the safety that people feel talking about these issues online. So I started out, I think about 15 years ago, starting and running online communities for women. And a lot of it is around like recreational stuff, like, oh, video games and other types of things where women are underrepresented. But then I started moving into communities where people were asking questions about relationships and sexual health and things like that. And I had to start thinking about, when these questions were up, like what kind of information was being told to them? Were people harassing them? Because when people are vulnerable and put out things around women's sexual health, a lot of folks on the internet will be drawn to that to harass people. So a lot of it came from learning how to safeguard these spaces while giving people the ability to actually talk about these issues, alongside the very tricky issue of, as a like a moderator of a community, you know, what is my responsibility for checking that kind of information that people are sharing about medical or sexual health and things like that? And then a lot of my work went into managing online crisis situations, specifically sex education, journalists covering issues covering issues in the US about Dobbs and all of these other kinds of things. Whenever people cover these issues or do that kind of education, it's like they are subject to not just abuse, but even social media platforms trying to take down their content because they associate sexual education with children threatening sexual content, right? So a lot of what I've been thinking about is how in the broader social media ecosystem, can these conversations happen? And like, what is the censorship that's happening? And a lot of it is from other communities online sort of trying to suppress that information. And, you know, as a result, you know, as you mentioned, I think a lot about the mental health and the kind of toll it takes on the people who are doing that work online, and including a lot of fact-checking organizations and advocacy organizations we work with who just have to constantly see that barrage of misinformation and like violence against women online. One thing that I thought was really hopeful that I've been working on and been learning a lot from a lot of our international partners is the potential for digital technologies to help women and girls who don't have a lot of access to information and maybe limited digital literacy, limited literacy or access to education. What are the ways that it's possible to make online spaces accessible to them? So with UNICEF, we're working on a platform called LAHA and introducing user forums, which obviously can introduce a lot of risks, but maybe this is a way for people who might have access to a phone just to access this forum that they can access that help where they wouldn't be able to offline, you know, either because of their families or many, many different types of limitations. So yeah, I sort of think about the prevention of, yeah, what is the censorship? What is causing fear among people talking about these issues, as well as what are potential for raising people up and being able to connect them to talk about these issues peer to peer?
Super helpful. Thank you. Thank you. And one of the things to be thinking about is thinking about the various vantage points that each of you bring. I wonder if you could each talk a little bit about what you see are some of the shifts in the last year, 2 years, but really the last year, like where we are now around access to information and misinformation and disinformation as we're thinking about sexual reproductive health or bodily autonomy in terms of the digital space. And I think really what I'm trying to get at is really for us to be able to see in the current moment, kind of what are some of the key issues we need to be thinking about. And I don't know, Kat, can I start with you this time and just kind of take us back down the road in a slightly different way?
Sure. I mean, I think with a lot of crises and in a lot of humanitarian crises, people lack access to especially very urgent resources and information. And so there's a lot of crises and political events that are making it putting a lot more people in vulnerable spaces. And in terms of online trends, we're seeing a lot of AI generated articles and information, you know, and then there's deep fakes. And so there are all of these technologies that are making it easier to spread misinformation, just like cause a huge amount of volume of information that's been auto-generated, that's only kind of correct, but nobody can tell if that's the thing that Google is surfacing, right? And then, yeah, with a lot of images, with deepfakes and things like that, that is often being used to threaten women online who are speaking out. And yeah, I just think there are quite a lot of information voids in a sense that are happening because, yeah, I think like either it's a moderation issue, people are kind of being censored from talking about it. It's not raising as much in the algorithms anymore in competition with all of this misinformation. So I think it's just getting very noisy online, like increasingly so.
Okay, super helpful. Esther, can I go to you? I'm just going back down the road the other way. So if I can.
So just a little bit going through what I mentioned in the introduction, that what we experienced in terms of the evidence and discussion we received and analysis through the journal. And again, most of our data is coming from the Global South that I think is very reflective of people lived experiences and documentation of also disparities around the world. So first of all, we have documented that the use of digital technologies has allowed for the expansion of sexual and reproductive health and services and the expanded access to more remote areas and underserved communities. Second, that we have started to document, especially during COVID, but also in relation to our self-care, especially issue with WHO, in terms of the digital divide on one hand between developed and developing countries. For example, in 2021, 2.9 billion people were still offline, and that 96% of them lived in developing countries. That has been also pointed out in a fantastic report of the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health in 2023. Then we experienced, we have a lot of articles published in different kind of context about the digital gender divide, that how the digital literacy of women and girls is lower than of their male counterparts. I mean, I don't mean to be binary here, but I'm also coming in terms of the broader gender divide, owing to societal biases against women in technology and the lack of access to the advanced education. A couple of days ago, we published an article that shows that, for example, in Kenya, looking at technology-based SRHR platforms indicated having a male population of between 60-70% and female population of between 30-40% who has an access to digital technology for various socio-political, gender, cultural norms. We also got more and more documentation about how digital technologies, despite of the advantages, can perpetuate violence, racism, sexism, ableism, discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, among others, and how the data is being misused. So especially, and we are getting more and more information in terms of how criminalization and misuse of data and digital technology is interconnected, and how people don't know that what they give information actually can be used against them. For example, in relation to abortion, when menstrual information or fertility tracking apps, through fertility tracking apps, information is gathered, then it's misused for access to abortion in criminalized settings. But also, for example, people living with HIV and advocates and policymakers are concerned about how an amazing technology on utilizing the benefits of molecular surveillance technology is actually also raising privacy and misuse of information concerns, especially in criminalized settings for sex workers when same-sex sexual orientation is criminalized. And my last point is about how actually misinformation and disinformation is kind of contextualized in an accountability system, when we in the past we were kind of connecting to, or we were accustomed that we have an account set of accountability actors in the SRHR world, but now it's expanded with the digital pace with those actors, especially private actors, who are not educated and not literate about SRHR accountability. So why they are promoting technology, they are not protecting privacy, confidentiality, informed consent, and completely falling out from the public health sector accountability systems that many accountability actors, government, state, Ministry of Health, are customized to. But all these entities, especially in the private sectors, they are not even aware of or care about that they are accountable for human rights and public health concerns and exclusion and gender-based discrimination and other forms of discrimination.
There's a lot there to think about. Okay, Anne, please.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think like Esther said, one of the really big things is just the increasing disparity with people who have access to the internet and their mobile phones, being able to just Google a word and see more wealth of images around sex and sexuality, you know, in a minute than their grandparents would have ever seen in a lifetime, right? It's a massive kangaroo jump into a whole universe that would not have been their parents' or their grandparents' experience. And that was something that I really started thinking about when going to internet cafes, and we used to use those more often. And if you just typing into the bar, you'll just see the amount of pornographic websites that people would access. But I think another big, it's hard to know the exact figures, but there's some estimates of between 10 and 15% of all internet traffic, right? And so I think the other big change is just increasing censorship of sexual health information online. You know, we at the Pleasure Project have a lot of issues with some of our content, and I know Lisa does as well, needing to kind of challenge Meta. And I know the Center for Intimacy Justice has been taking a case to the Supreme Court in the US to challenge how there's such a gender bias around the type of sexuality and sexual health information that is able to get through the censorship. And it's very striking when you see what, you know, how much Viagra can be advertised and yet how sex toys for female identifying people can't be. So I think that's one. But I think, you know, also there has been an increasing recognition of the impact that access to explicit media is having. And there's more research into that. But there's also, in terms of opportunities, there's also a lot of really exciting work which uses digital technology for sex education. So in the research we did with the World Health Organization, there was an amazing intervention trial which used an app-based format called MyDex, which then kind of emulated a dating app to then deliver sex education information that was also around emotional intelligence in dating, that was very, and very, very pleasure positive and sex positive. We've also worked with the International Planned Parenthood Federation in Africa to last year deliver a big campaign called Treasure Your Pleasure on digital platforms. And that was phenomenally successful. And it had like 9 million followers. The engagement was really high. And it just showed the extent to which it was targeted at young people, the extent to which young people have a thirst for this content that is both sex positive, pleasure inclusive, but also accurate and respectful and based on sexual rights. And I know there's just been an article published in SRHR Matters about a chatbot in Kenya that showed when they changed to pleasure-focused content, pleasure-focused sexual health content, there was a massive increase in the amount of people using the chatbot to get sexual health information and to understand where they could go for services. So I think there's lots of opportunities. And just lastly, we at the Pleasure Project are about to do an event called Pleasuring Up Wikipedia, in which we are getting our community of pleasure practice to become experienced editors of Wikipedia. And I recently just went to a similar event, and I'm super enthusiastic now about making sure that there's more diverse editors on Wikipedia. I mean, Wikipedia is largely edited by cis, white, heterosexual men in North America. That's what the evidence shows. And, you know, if we want to correct misinformation and make sure that it's more, actually on Wikipedia, it's more about the silenced areas and the gaps when it comes to sexual health information. And so we're doing a kind of audit of where we want to add content that's actually good SRHR content, but also pleasure-focused content. And we're going to hold a wikithon to actually change content on Wikipedia. So there's opportunities to also make sure that we're filling the silenced areas and these platforms that are just, you know, have massive accessibility as well. So I think there is lots of opportunities as well. Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks for getting us to think about starting to move us into strategy. Sorry, Lisa, please go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks so much. From my perspective in India, I want to actually just share a little context about just where we're at in terms of the access to rights that citizens are even granted by the law here. For example, homosexuality was only decriminalized in 2018. Marital rape is still legal. The National Family Health Survey data indicates that less than 5% of people use condoms. When you're looking at just the baseline of existing access and information around sexual and reproductive health and rights, there's so much room for improvement, right? And so the internet seemed like this one space where you could have freer conversations. If the government is saying you should be legally allowed to rape your wife and you cannot legally be allowed to be gay, right? The most credible sort of source of values, things like that, is the courts and the government in a country like India. Citizens have a lot of reverence for those institutions, right? And so, and the family as well. So if your parents and the Prime Minister and the Supreme Court and whatever, all of these institutions that are supposed to be telling you as citizens what to believe, are couching, you know, very anti-rights sentiments as laws and our culture and things like that, there's so much unlearning to allow for the possibility of something else. And initially, the internet, I think, was a space, particularly for young people, particularly for women and queer people, to share and access information and lived experiences and also sort of just an awareness of one's rights. And what's so disheartening is that more recently, all of those same stakeholders that were perpetuating the oppression and denying access to rights to large groups of people have also found their way to the internet. They're much more powerful than the citizens sharing their lived experiences or the sex educators or the pleasure positive adult filmmakers or whoever else is trying to do their little thing. And so I think now the internet has become just like everything the mainstream media and the more conservative governments and your family members and whatever else, all of those people have found their way on there. And so I think what's even worse is that these very left, seemingly left-leaning American platforms, Meta, Google, they posited themselves as like these beacons of information, of truthful information, of joyful information, right? At least in India, there was the tendency to look up to a Western country, and particularly the United States, as some sort of like freer place, a better place, a place where people have more rights. And unfortunately, quite the opposite seems to be happening, where, I mean, today in India, it's probably easier to get an abortion than it is in many parts of the US. And Instagram is censoring me, you know, and it's not an India thing, it's a US thing. So I think everything went a bit topsy-turvy, and it's hard to make sense of the world really, because there seems to be a lack of interest in what is factual. And instead, the various stakeholders that used to stay out of the internet have made their way in and are causing censorship to take on such heights that even someone like me is having to self-censor instead of even waiting for the platform to censor me. I just don't say things anymore or have to use euphemisms or just, I mean, there's some topics that are just so hard to address that you try and, you know, find other ways of doing it, such as an email or where people are opting in, because to just put it out there even makes you vulnerable. Like, how dare you publicly talk about this thing? We're going to come after you, you know? I think there was so much positive sort of change that came thanks to the internet and social media, and people are finding ways to use it to achieve that still. But it's very disheartening that what seemed like this place of independence and free thinking and more honesty and more open-mindedness rapidly became just one more machine to propagate the same oppressions that were already dominant in every other sphere of media and public life.
Super hear you. And can I just say that before we move into talking about strategies, all of you actually have raised a lot of issues to be thinking about and to be concerned about. I wanted to do, if I could, just a quick lightning round, where literally just to ask each of you really quickly what you consider to be the greatest challenge we need to be aware of. Right? What, with all of the issues you've raised and all of these others, what's the greatest challenge as far as you see it? Esther, can I just start with you?
Yes. I mean, it's difficult to prioritize. I mean, what preoccupies me and many of our community members right now is really the mind-blowing misuse of evidence by the anti-sexual and reproductive health and rights and gender movement, and how prominent, for example, UN actors like the US Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, who's supposed to promote especially the rights and needs of marginalized populations like transgender people and sex workers, is misusing information in terms of, we have no idea what kind of agenda to promote, but definitely not an agenda of lived realities of transgender and sex workers, and promoting, for example, that sex workers, every sex work is violence, and a non-evidence-based information that transgender people are, by definition, are sex predators when it comes, for example, using of public toilets. I mean, it seems to be nuances, but you would expect prominent actors who has a great voice around the world to be very careful how their information, that is very powerful, is evidence-based and reflects the needs and concerns and identified issues of marginalized communities. So I will give another example, if I have a chance, about sexuality education, but I think we are looking for new tools and new alliances and new partnerships, how to reinstate the scientific and rights-based rigor around information and evidence, and not to take it anymore for granted that what we call is evidence-based is always actually based on scientific evidence, and how to counter these voices that has actually harmful effects. And just to come to the digital, how the media, who supposed to be responsible actors, are picking up this information and further torturing the evidence that is not there, presenting like it would be evidence-based information. So I think it's a new era that I think the scientific community is really, we need to reestablish what does it mean scientific. And I can give you maybe in the other round very good example about it, how we can do it, but we need to wake up that we need to do it.
Thank you. All right. Lightning round. Okay. All right. Lisa, please.
I think one of the big challenges alongside censorship, which I mentioned earlier, is that a lot of the anti-rights brigade actually uses the optics of feminism, the language of left-leaning activism, and then turns it on its head in the messaging. And so when an audience that's receiving that isn't sure where they stand and maybe is young and kind of thinks they want to be progressive, it can be very confusing when exactly the opposite of progressive is using the sort of imagery as well as vocabulary of rights-based activism to actually further an anti-rights agenda.
Totally. Gotcha. Anne?
Just building on what Esther and Lisa said, I think also another big challenge is making the sexual and reproductive health world or others creating content that is appealing and accessible and evidence-based that will be watched or accessed as much as other content is being accessed. So really upping our game to make sure that it's appealing and provides a much better frame for understanding their sexuality and what a vision for their sex lives could be, because currently people are deriving that from porn, you know, with very negative consequences in terms of the assumptions they're making about what their sex life might be. So I think just as appealing content and erotic content, but content that is based on sexual rights and is feminist and respectful.
Thanks, Kat.
You know, I think I was going to say something for the previous question that I forgot. But yeah, I also definitely want to affirm what everybody has been saying with like a lot of these influencers. I think Esther said like the sort of almost the performance of presenting evidence or scientific rigor. It's like people have mastered kind of an aesthetic or a performance of legitimacy of people feeling like, oh, this influencer has done the research, but it really is for a number of things. Maybe it's for their diet pill, who knows, that they're selling. I think people don't have the literacy to understand, yeah, like, is this influencer telling me the right thing or is that influencer? And so people don't have those tools. But then I guess the greatest challenge that I'm sort of transitioning into is that social media companies are dedicating fewer resources now to this issue, right? So like, what are they doing for misinformation? There used to be more resources pushed towards helping fact-checking organizations, fact-check information on social media, plugging into the content moderation system and making it easy to surface, like, this is misinformation. Here's an article to the accurate misinformation. So, you know, there was previously more curation trying to bring in experts on the platform side, even not enough, obviously, but now it's becoming increasingly less. And so we're seeing, yeah, that decrease of resources without people necessarily understanding that's what's happening. So these types of labeling strategies or ways to redirect people to better resources, like, that's not as present anymore. And I think really not a lot of resources for people to gain that literacy is presented to them in the first place online. But in terms of making equitable access to those spaces, you know, Twitter was bought by Elon Musk, and a lot of Twitter's resources on like managing online abuse and misinformation, especially regarding like trans rights, reproductive rights, and things like that. There's just much less support around that. You can report something and it won't get taken down anymore if you misgender some, or if, you know, somebody misgenders somebody, for example. So basically fewer support there. Also limited resources in protecting yourself. So, you know, I'll probably talk about this more later, but being able to use like mute, block, ban, reporting people so that they don't impact not just you, but your community, because blocking and banning only helps you essentially, or can only protect you essentially. So it's that social media platforms are giving us very little agency, very few tools, very few resources to combat the problems that they're sending towards us by making it very easy to absorb mis and disinformation over that accurate information. The sort of final issue there is we don't know the extent of it because social media platforms aren't transparent about what's happening. We don't know the scale of it. We don't know where it's happening, those networks. Like, we have general external research, but companies are shutting off all of their access to information that we as researchers can look into.
You all have listed such a host of real challenges in terms of what it is that we need to be thinking about. I want to try to move us into, I mean, I literally started to make this enormously long list and thinking, my goodness, how are we going to work with this? So, but just to say, look, you've each also been thinking about how to address some of these challenges. And I want to, and I'm conscious of time, right? We're close, but what I would love is both Anne and Lisa, as content creators, can you talk some about how you, in the context of your work, address information, misinformation, and disinformation, particularly in the increasingly challenging legal environments that we're all living in our respective countries? Which one of you would like to go first?
I think one thing that's really important is not just the legal challenges, but actually the challenges from the gatekeepers in the sexual and reproductive health world. So one thing that we've done is a big systematic review and meta-analysis with the World Health Organization and the UN Joint Programme on Human Reproduction. And as I said before, there were some great examples of intervention studies that used digital technology and used pleasure-focused content. And what we found overall, the conclusion of the systematic review was that pleasure-inclusive sexual health content and asset-framed and sex-positive content has a much bigger impact on sexual health, a significant and positive impact on condom use, on reduction in sexually transmitted infections. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is because I think that evidence has helped to shift hearts and minds around the importance of providing honest, real, pleasure-inclusive content in the world that tends to produce biomedical content and tends to focus on the negative consequences of sex. And I think that takes us some of the way to be able to kind of work in this space. We've taken that evidence and we've created something called the Pleasure Principles, which you'll find on our website, which is operational guidance to how to actually deliver this evidence and best practice. And some of that relates to language and starting a conversation. And all of this is relevant to the digital space as well. And I think, as I said right at the beginning, we need to work between the public health world and the pleasure world, because they have a lot to learn from each other. And that is the only way that we're going to be able to create the kind of content I was talking about before, which is going to be appealing and accurate and will challenge this massive amount of content that's coming, this sexually explicit media, which is very inaccurate, is violent, is sexist. We need to create a community of practice to support each other. So with the Pleasure Principles, we have organizations that have endorsed them, and we now have 35, which is amazing, including explicit media content creators, including sexual and reproductive health service delivery organizations, and the biggest five sexual and reproductive health delivery organizations globally, international organizations. And we have fascinating conversations about exactly this, like the different types of content we produce and how we can learn from each other. And I think one of the pleasure principles is about supporting each other, love yourself, and how you need to kind of unlearn the shame that you've learned, but also how we need to support each other in this world of pleasure stigma, and how some of us suffer to a greater extent because of all of the things we've been talking about, but because our gender identity is marginalized, our sexual identity is marginalized, or there's a greater amount of shame that has been socialized into us because of our sexuality. So I think those are just some strategies that I think is important. And I'll hand over to Lisa.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks so much. I agree with everything that Anne said. And I know we're really getting to the end of the conversation time-wise. But I would add to that that I think shame resilience in young people and young women and young queer people particularly is so important, because when your identity and your rights and your access to information, simply accessing information in the SRH domain, is considered shameful. It is a shameful thing to do for a young woman to look up information about sex. Like, that's where we're at still. And therefore, I think not only accessing information, but also stopping yourself. Like, not only are you vulnerable to misinformation, you don't even think you deserve information. And I think that's such a dangerous and sad place for a young person to be. And unfortunately, that is where many, many, many young people, and particularly young women, are in my part of the world, but also in actually increasingly in your part of the world as well, right? And so I think if there's one thing that we can encourage young people to fortify themselves with, is this shame resilience. Question everything, including your parents and your leaders and your teachers and the law and everything, you know, and like, think for yourself. I think critical thinking, media literacy, shame resilience, like, how do we get people to be able to discern innately between what is most likely false and what is most likely rights-based and true? It seems almost impossible to learn anymore, but I hope that we can somehow manage to achieve that.
Yeah, I think we all do, right? Just to say to Esther and to Kat, look, you represent very different kinds of organizations and approaches from one another, as well as from what we've just heard in terms of addressing these intersections. So could you say something about the steps you're taking to address these issues, the kinds of things you prioritize? I have to frame this as if resources were not the key issue, since we all know that the first issue is going to be what gets resourced and et cetera. But I would really be interested in ways that you think that these issues can be addressed in the current moment. And if it's okay, Kat, may I start with you?
Yeah. So a few things that, so at Median, a lot of what we do is work with journalists and human rights advocates to basically run tip lines so that people can send in information through WhatsApp, which is often the only messaging platform or the only way that people can sort of access online interaction. Like, you know, because WhatsApp ends up being, especially in the greater world, the most accessible way to log on in a sense. So how do you make it so that people who can't sort of peruse the internet the same way we can, where we have high-speed internet, you know, how can we disseminate that information? How can they have access to organizations that can send them good, accurate information? So being able to make that kind of access wider so that more people know, like, hey, you can text this tip line and they'll send you the accurate information. Resources like that. Right now, we're working with a number of sort of feminist organizations in documenting disinformation, gender disinformation, especially towards female politicians and public figures, and just understanding the extent of it, right? Like, what is the nature of it? And what are those narratives so we can actually counter the narratives that are being spread around? Because I think knowing what people are saying in the first place can be hard, given that we have these different types of bubbles that we might exist in and so on. So I think those types of efforts, but then also advocacy efforts around policy, right? Like, how do we make it so in the US, for example, that politicians don't create more legislation that causes companies to have to moderate anything associated with sexual content more, right? So in the US, FOSTA-SESTA was a kind of anti-sex trafficking law that held companies accountable to kind of hosting certain types of content. But as a result, companies just started taking down all content related to sex work and things like that. And so legislation that is not very careful ends up doing a lot of suppression of sexual conversation, health, and so on online. So doing that type of advocacy as well as these consortiums of organizations that have that are informed about the impacts of lack of access to information online, lack of safety for sex workers and their ability to connect, and so on, and making sure that policy is informed by those perspectives.
Thanks. Esther, please.
I will be very short because I know that we have only 3 minutes. I just would like to call the attention that it's the year for ICPD plus 30. And we just reviewed all the events and related opportunities that are happening around the world this year. So if, and I think it's not that if finances wouldn't be an issue, I think we need accountability from the funders and from the funding community to invest in the sexual and reproductive health and rights movement that includes researchers, academics, young people, civil society, community-based groups, enabling state actors, parliamentarians, judges, and others to address sexual and reproductive rights issues. So many events and platforms are happening in the context of ICPD plus 30. I think we need to reflect on it, that ICPD happened in a very different context, exactly because of the digital partly and how the digital and politics is connected 30 years ago. So when we think about ICPD plus 30, how we think about that ICPD plus 30 is happening in the digital world that is influencing politics, science, access to services, activism, safety of vulnerable populations. So how we actually look at it in a very holistic way, making sure that sexual and reproductive health and rights are ensured, and we as a community, that is community meanings of all these actors acting together. And I think it's not regardless of resources. We need resources for this. So the funders has to be part of this discussion as well.
Okay, look, everybody, this has been the fastest hour ever, if I may say, just to start. Look, I'd like to give each of you 1 minute, and I literally mean 1 minute because we're going to go over just by a minute or two by doing that. And I'd like you, please, to round up, and you have 1 minute to basically say anything that you heard that you want to make sure you clarify, any questions in the Q&A that you feel that you want to respond to, and anything you might want to say to young people interested in these issues who are online about what they should be doing, what are actions they can take. You obviously can't take them all on, but each of you just as a lightning round to go. Anne, can I start with you?
Gosh, that's really challenging because there was a lot in that. I don't know. You'd ask like what young people could do. So that's what I heard. So, I mean, not that I'm going to tell young people what they can do, but I think if you're interested in these issues, like study them, you know, get to know the content, try and get your lived experience reflected in social media content. I think, you know, a bit like to my point about get involved with editing Wikipedia, you know, get involved with creating more exciting, accurate content online. I'm sure I could say a lot more, but that's it.
I'm sure you could. And I think we need to have more of these conversations for sure. Okay. If I can go then to Lisa.
I think that more of us need to talk with those who we don't agree with, mainly and talking only to people who already agree with us. And I think that is a problem. Very young people on social media, it's almost trendy like to stand for something. And then anyone who doesn't agree with you, you don't even engage with. But how does if you're only talking to your own friends and not willing at all to try and get people who might not have had the privileges or the education or the whatever that led you to have a rights-based approach and them not to. I think if there's no bridge, there's no progress.
Gotcha. Absolutely. Kat.
My advice or thing I think is important is that people should be interdisciplinary. Like people should sort of try to speak multiple languages. I mean, literally and metaphorically, in that, for example, like in the technology space, yeah, you should be doing gender studies. You should be understanding like health, but it helps if you're also an engineer. You know, if you're also a technologist, they're more likely to listen to you because they're like, oh, so you get it, right? So being able to speak to multiple types of people, I think it's really important to cultivate that kind of skill. And it reminds me with Wikipedia too. Wikipedia editors are really obscure in their requirements. So they'll revert your changes if it doesn't follow the exact type of procedure and like language that they prefer. So, you know, a lot of like these sort of, yeah, being able to speak across the board is important.
Okay, Esther, last word.
Be curious about what evidence and rights-based knowledge means, created through digital places and used through digital places in terms of expanding the boundaries of evidence. So evidence includes not only randomized controlled trials and quantitative methodologies, but also documenting the voices of affected populations. On the other hand, be curious about that how what is claimed to be evidence might be actually not evidence, and learn the methodologies, how dismantle fake data, fake evidence, and use it and connect it to knowledge to action.
Thank you. Look, thank all of you. I mean, this was amazing. And I just honestly, we could just go on and on. So I just, there's so much to learn. I want to thank you speakers for your comments, but really for the honesty of your remarks and for pushing us really to think in new and important ways. And there's so much to do. Thank you, everybody in the audience, for being there and for your excellent questions that we couldn't even get to. And to everybody for your interest and commitment. And so with that, I'm going to say goodbye. And let's say that there will be more conversations later, and we should just all continue to connect. All best, everybody. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the SRHM podcast. Please check the show notes for a link to the SRHM issue on digital technology and sexual and reproductive health and rights. We will also soon be publishing a special collection on sexual pleasure in partnership with the Pleasure Project. Follow SRHM Journal on social media and sign up for our newsletter to receive notifications on new publications. Thank you for supporting the SRHM podcast, which is produced by our staff. The music was composed by Thibert Christian and Solomon Boton.